The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can. For $3 a month, just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com. Don't forget, I have two other podcasts, From John to Justin and Pucks and Cups, which release every single week and are available on all podcast platforms. Today I'm speaking with John McFarlane, who, along with Lynn Salmon, wrote the book Around the World in a Dugout Canoe. It looks at the untold story of Captain John Voss and the Tillicum. It's a really actually interesting story because he traveled around the world essentially in a canoe. He went through a series of first mates, and he made the journey, and it took him several years. And he was just an interesting individual to begin with, and I really enjoyed this book. So let's get right to the interview. What inspired you to write about Voss and his epic journey in this canoe around the world?
Well, 30-odd years ago, I was the director of the Maritime Museum of British Columbia. And one of the big exhibits that they had in the museum at that time, and probably the largest item in their collection, was the actual dugout canoe Tillicum. And every morning when I went in and opened up the museum so that we could go public every day, I had to step behind this vessel on display to turn on the lights. And so my hand would go up onto the deck, and I began to think about the vessel and the Captain Voss. More and more and more, I started to have a kind of spiritual connection with it. To be honest, in that very earliest time of my contact with it, I knew that the vessel was a significant part of British Columbia's heritage. And I knew that it had gone on quite a dramatic international voyage, but I didn't really know much about the details. I read Captain Voss's book, which was published in 1913, and I read the book written by the first of his many mates, Norman Luxton, which was published in 1970. And so those were obviously firsthand accounts, and I took those to be the truth, to be accurate and to be the complete story. But the more I investigated the books, the more questions kept being raised. There were inconsistencies. There were, looked like mistakes in the books. It looked like there were pieces that were left out or got mixed up. And so it occurred to me that I could do an edited version of this story and that it would kind of fix these problems. And it wasn't so simple. The more I delved into it, the more and more and more difficult this whole story became. Then life intervened, and I stopped working on the project for about 20-odd years. And I was contacted about 5 years ago by a publisher in Paris who was publishing a book about the 100 greatest sailors in all of history. And they considered Captain Voss to be one of those, which was a bit of a surprise to me to see that he was on the considered on the same level as famous explorers and Captain Cook and people like that. So it was a big book. It had 100 chapters, and they gave me one chapter with 4 pages in it to tell the story. So I wrote the 4 pages, which they liked, and it just didn't seem to me to even begin to scratch the surface. So I thought that this would be an interesting article for a magazine. And I began to write a magazine article about it. And when the magazine article hit 40 pages, I knew that it had to be a book.
Absolutely. When you start reading the book, you really explore Voss, who he was, and he's a really interesting character. I mean, there's rumors that he Shanghai people who were drinking at his pub. He's obviously a very experienced and skilled sailor. Like, there's no question about that. But what type of person was Voss? Like, was he somebody who was trying to make a buck? Was he an explorer? Was he all of those things?
I think he was a very complex character who changed through his life. Mm-hmm. So he started out as a sailing master of full rigged ships, sailing on the open ocean. And so he was a short, burly, really tough character. And I think in those days, he was probably quite an unpleasant person. When he came ashore, he went into business. He wasn't a very good businessman. So to be, again, really frank, he operated on the far side of the law. He was actually a wanted character by the United States authorities on their most wanted list at one time for smuggling drugs into the United States. He trafficked in moving Asian people across from Canada into the United States. And yes, indeed, in his pub in Crofton, British Columbia, he would drug young men who would wake up the next morning on a sailing ship bound for Asia or Australia or someplace foreign, and having been paid handsomely by the masters of these vessels who needed to make up a crew. So he was a pretty tough and nasty character in those early days. Mm-hmm. But over time, he seems to have mellowed, especially during and after his voyage. He became quite a suave charmer. He met prime ministers and presidents. He met archbishops. He met famous war heroes. People sought him out for his company and for his stories. And he became a close friend of Sir Ernest Shackleton, the Antarctic explorer. He was noted as a storyteller and was very, very popular late in his life on the social scene.
One thing that I kind of found weird, in he travels all the way around the world. He gets to South America, Brazil, and then rather than continue north or even take it over, you know, that brief little area of Panama, because this is before the Panama Canal, he goes to England rather than, say, go to like Quebec City or Montreal. Why did he choose kind of to go that way than technically complete the voyage by going back to Canada?
Well, we're not entirely sure, but the whole point of his voyage, which was a stunt, was to become rich and famous. Mm-hmm. So he was constantly looking for venues in which to achieve that goal. I think he heard that there was a big exhibition in London at that time, which was the Naval and Fisheries Exhibition of 1905. And he thought that he could get a lot of revenue by putting his boat on display at this exhibition. It was kind of sort of like a World's Fair, a big exhibition in Earl's Court, international participation. And so he headed to England. Now, he really should have continued again south around South America back to Victoria in order to complete the voyage. But he declared in England that he had circumnavigated the globe, which he clearly had not. If you look at the map, it's clearly not a circumnavigation. And he lost interest in the voyage and sold the boat to a yachtsman as a yacht. Mm-hmm. And he then went on to South America, where he did some treasure hunting, ended up back in Victoria running the lifeboat there. He went on to Japan, spent a number of years living in Japan, and then he ended his life penniless as a taxi driver in Tracy, California. So he didn't make very much money in London. I think that's where he began to lose faith. But he had been on his voyage for 3.5 years, and I think he was beginning to become a little bit of old news that he had been a media darling, really a rock star of his day for most of the voyage, but he really wore out his story in England, and people lost interest and moved on to other topics.
Mm-hmm. When you look at your book, there's kind of three characters. There's Voss, there's his series of first mates, and then there's the canoe, the Tilikum. And so even though Voss didn't complete the journey, the canoe did, but it had kind of its own life after Voss essentially abandoned it. Is the story of the canoe after that, like its life after that journey, is that part of like the whole story? Like, is that something you wanted to do to kind of show how the canoe also got back to Victoria eventually?
Yes. It's very unusual. If you look back through the history of small craft voyaging, for the vessels to survive, the stories survive, the pictures survive, but very, very seldom the vessels survive. And this is one exception to the rule. And it's a very unusual vessel. It's quite large. Mm-hmm. It had been abandoned in England. It was abandoned on the mudflats and was full of mud. It really should have just rotted away there. But for some reason, people in England gave notice of this situation to authorities in Victoria. And people in Victoria felt such a keen kinship with this vessel that they demanded that it be brought back to Victoria and to be put on display, which was done. It was rescued, it was cleaned out, put on the deck of a freighter and shipped through the Panama Canal to Victoria. And it sat on display in a number of different venues before ending up inside the Maritime Museum on Bastion Square. Until fairly recently, the people of Victoria have felt that the vessel belonged to them. Now, they may not have fully understood the story. They may, in fact, have been able to recall very little of the story other than the fact that it was Captain Voss and that it sailed around the world. Yeah. But they were very keen that it should be in Victoria and be accessible on display. The vessel eventually ended up inside the Maritime Museum. And when the Maritime Museum became evicted from their quarters in 2015, it was moved into storage, where it's still very safe and sound, but inaccessible to the public.
One of the big stories of the journey, and it's one that you touch on for quite a bit, is the fact that the second of his first mates died while on the way to Australia. And it's pretty clear, like you present the story, like it is very clear that this was an accidental death. But why do tales of murder persist? Is it just because people like those, you know, those dark tales of the sea? Is that why? And then obviously the Luxon wrote about it and made some accusations, or at least his daughter did.
Yes. There was no question at the time that it was an accident, but a careless comment that Norman Luxon made in the manuscript of his book, which, by the way, there was a note in the book that it said to his daughter that this was strictly as a reminiscence for her, that he never intended for the book to be published. He, of course, owned a newspaper and a printing press. He could have published the book anytime if he had really wanted it to be published. And he left this character assassination of a note in the book, which said that Voss had murdered his mate. I don't know whether he hoped that the book would eventually be published or what, but so the whole idea of the voyage had been Norman Luxton's. He had read Joshua Slocum's book, Sailing Alone Around the World, and realized that Joshua Slocum had become world famous and rich from the lectures and from the sales of the book. And so he got it into his head that he could say it, do a similar stunt, and that that they would become rich and famous by out-Slocuming Slocum. And so he needed, of course, somebody to get him around the world. He was not a sailor himself. He was a journalist. So he thought he would write the books and write the articles and do the publicity. And his friend, who just lived a few blocks away, Captain Voss, would get them around the world safely. His original idea was to buy a sealing schooner, which Voss dismissed immediately and said that that was too easy, that anybody could sail around the world in a sealing schooner. What they really needed to do was to do this in a dugout canoe. He said that would attract a lot of attention, and that would be the catalyst for making them famous. And he was convinced that he could deliver on the, getting them around safely. Luxton bought into this in a very serious way, and he made a lot of boasts publicly about what they were going to achieve, to the point where when he decided partway through the voyage that he wanted to abandon the voyage, he really needed an alibi, an explanation of why this was happening, something that where he could save face. So he concocted this idea, which he states in his book, that he thought Voss was going to kill him. He also had an accident on a reef and got some coral poisoning, which must have made the situation worse. But all the way across the Pacific, they were together on a very small boat. In the cabin of the boat was so small that it could only hold one of them, but the other one had to sit outside for 12 hours a day while the other one was inside, either sleeping or cooking or washing or doing something. They could never be more than a few feet apart. And you can only imagine, after a couple of months of this, they got really a serious case of cabin fever. And they, I think, got to the point where they really detested each other. Now, old Voss, of course, was a sailing ship captain, and he was used to giving barking orders. And if they weren't instantly obeyed, no doubt he associated that with a number of threats about what he would do if, you know, if you don't move faster, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do grievous bodily harm on you. And I think because of the cabin fever, Luxton began to actually believe that these threats were real, that Voss intended to do the things that he was threatening. And he began to realize, I have to get off this boat. But he couldn't figure out how he was going to do this and save face. Anyway, when they got to Fiji, he said, okay, that's it. I've had enough. And he found this young mate who eventually was washed overboard on the way to Australia. Luxton carried on to Australia. And when Voss arrived and the mate was dead, that was perfect. That was the explanation. I left the voyage because I knew Voss was going to kill me as he killed the next fellow who was the mate. And you can see this chain of events. Over the years, apparently, as I read in newspaper articles when Luxton was interviewed, the story started out that Voss was a drunkard and not to be trusted. And then after about 20 years, the story evolved to where he was a drunkard and was threatening to kill Luxton to the point where then Luxton said, I had to leave the voyage because I knew that I would be murdered. He put this note in his book, and his daughter Eleanor published the book, and it said, Voss was a murderer. He killed his mate, and he was a drunkard, and a lot of other bad character references. So I think it's explainable, but not forgivable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Looking at Voss, you know, for all of his the not so great things, the great things, the fact is, like, he did make an incredible journey. With his first mates, he would have several days where he'd have a first mate who was seasick because they were getting used to it. So a lot of this was essentially by himself. But what can we learn from Voss in terms of our own goals, our own hopes, things we want to accomplish?
Well, you have to remember at the time, yachtsmen almost never sailed offshore. They were coastal sailors. A few sailors sailed across the Atlantic. One or two had sailed across the Pacific. And only Joshua Slocum had sailed around the world. He did so alone, by the way. He didn't have a mate with him. And Voss, through his public lectures and his contact with the press, popularized the idea of challenge blue water sailing. So these things that we still see today, you see it in the headlines, the youngest person ever sailed around the world, the oldest person, the oldest woman, the oldest man, somebody who sails around single-handed five times. They stop, or they do it unassisted, nonstop. Mm-hmm. All of that started with John Voss, and he has inspired generations of people to take on these, ridiculously dangerous voyages and difficult voyages, because people looked at how he did it and said, well, if he could do it, I can do it. Mm-hmm.
It is a massive achievement, even though, like you said, technically he didn't go around the world. He did go an immense amount of distance, and 3 years.
40,000 miles, yes.
Exactly, yeah. So technically around the world in terms of kilometer-wise. But why is it not something that we even really know about in Canada? Because it is kind of a Canadian story. Mm-hmm. It was a Canadian. It came from Canada, the canoes in Canada. But like I said, even I didn't even know about this until I received your book. So why are we not celebrating this more like we would something like Skokum or even Magellan or anything else that has to do with circumnavigation?
Well, perhaps about 1960, this was a story that was well known in Canada, and it would appear in retold in newspapers regularly across Canada. But gradually it came a little bit out of fashion. The story is still right in the forefront of the minds of people who follow stories of the sea in Australia, New Zealand, in London. I've been contacted by people all over the world. Captain Voss's book is still in print after 110 years. It's never been out of print. It's been translated into a dozen languages. When I was the director of the Maritime Museum, I met yachtsmen from Siberia who sailed to Victoria specifically to see the Tilikum because they had read the Russian edition of Venturesome Voyages. The Japanese sail training ships that came to Victoria always made a pilgrimage to the museum to have a look at the vessel and to hear the story. Before the fall of the Soviet regime in Eastern Europe, people would dream about doing these kinds of voyages, Polish and Czechs and other people, because it represented to them the ultimate freedom of living close to nature and undertaking a difficult task. It was something that they dreamed about. And even now, I've been contacted by people in many, many countries who feel that it's a story that's very much alive in their minds. Mm-hmm. But it's very odd to me that the story has become almost completely forgotten in British Columbia and in the rest of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it was one of my goals was to bring it back up into the forefront.
And you do an excellent job of it with that book. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. So in terms of his journey, do you feel like is it luck that he made it? Is it skill? Is it a combination of both? Because essentially, like you said, it's a canoe. It's not a big boat. It's a big wave can take this thing out completely. And numerous times in the book, you talk about how he thinks he's going to die. There was that time where something was wrong with him until he drank that mustard solution that seemed to heal him. Was it just a combination of just skill and luck that he was able to survive this?
Well, I think he was a really tough character. And I mean, really tough. Mm-hmm. He was able to put up with the most terrible living conditions on board the vessel. And as he talks about how in the course of the voyage over the 3.5 years, he grew to love this little vessel more and more and more. It must have been absolutely terrifying for his mates, at least, if not for him, to be sitting in the cockpit of that vessel about 18 inches off the water with huge waves, monster waves all around them. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, no radio, no weather reports, no radar, no aids of any kind. Mm-hmm. And even at night, no light. He just had a little candle in the binnacle so he could read the compass. He couldn't swim. He wasn't tied to the boat with a lifeline. He didn't wear a life preserver. They would have been wet all the time. Mm-hmm. They would have been hungry and thirsty. And yet, as it went on, he grew to love that vessel more and more and more, and to believe in its capabilities. He believed that the shape of the hull, the design, this technology, which had been honed over thousands of years by canoe carvers on the west coast of Canada, he came to supremely believe that this was the finest possible design for a small craft. He also believed that there were some scientific principles which could be deduced, which, if learned, would allow any seaman to safely handle a small boat in any conditions that you can imagine. And now I've been told by many single-handed circumnavigators that some of his ideas are quite wacky, and that he might have actually been very lucky. On the other hand, they said he obviously had seamanship skills mm-hmm. that were so superlative that perhaps it would be difficult to find many other seamen who could equal them. But he certainly was able to handle that little boat under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, when he crossed the Pacific, it had no engine, so he only visited islands that the wind and currents took him to. He had a one-sheet map of the Pacific Ocean that showed islands big enough to show up on a one-sheet map. And that was all he had in order to get across, that and the compass. And he took, of course, sun sights with his sextant every day and plotted the positions on the map. Other than that, he just seemed to have supreme confidence that he was going to get to where he was going and everything would be fine.
Absolutely. And then just the last question is, if people want to find the book, where can they find it? If they want to learn more about the story, what can they do?
Is that showing right way around on your screen?
It is. Yep. Yep.
Good. The book, Around the World in a Dugout Canoe, is available through your local independent booksellers. It's also available through Canada's History Magazine, and it's available through Amazon online. It's in print.
Mm-hmm. And it's a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it. And that was all my questions. The only thing that bothered me about the journey was the woman in New Zealand who gave him the cake to take to her son.
Yes.
And I know he couldn't get to the island. Like, I understand why, but it really bothered me that he never delivered it. And then he ate it later on. And for some reason, it was like, I'm sure that this poor guy was waiting for this wonderful cake. And even though Voss did need it, it would have been nice to deliver that.
Yes. And I think his mate gave it away when he couldn't understand why Voss wasn't making more of an effort to land the boat on Cocos Island, and they sailed by. And as soon as he had sailed by, he says to the mate, go up and get that package. And when they opened it up, there was the cake. And the mate says, ah, now I know why we didn't land.
Yeah.
And of course, when they got to South Africa, there was a telegram waiting for him, which said, where's my cake?
Yeah. For some reason, that was the only thing that bothered me was, You could have delivered that. Like, that was the one thing you had. He could have done, but I understand, yes, too, because it's probably the best cake he ever had in his life, because they were pretty hungry by that point.
Yes. The circumnavigators who read the story said, they scratched their head too and said, you know, it's pretty hard. If you can see Cocos Island, they said, there's no particular reason why he couldn't have made landfall there. They said he sailed by because he wanted to sail by.
Yeah, he wanted that cake. He was thinking of that cake. That was wonderful. Yeah, yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with John McFarlane. And if you did, please leave a rating and review.
You can also visit my website, where you'll find all my podcast episodes, as well as hundreds of articles on Canada's history. Just go to CanadaEHX.com. And again, you can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX, just like all of these wonderful patrons have. And I apologize if I mispronounce any names. Gary Dolovich, Nick Zinri, Pamela Elder, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., Vic Hedges, JP Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, Spencer M., and Iris Gray. You can also find me on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/CanadianHistoryX. And I'm on Twitter. Just go to Craig Baird, CraigBaird. I'm also on Instagram. And you just have to look for Bairdo37.
Thanks. We'll see you again next time.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.